Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Equal Time for Free Thought's Easter Day Special. On Equal Time for Free Thought, we explore a non-religious worldview based on scientific naturalism and secular humanism, and how this worldview can help us become a more equitable, socially just, and peaceful society. I'm Arnell DeRay, and tonight our Easter basket is very full indeed. We'll be featuring two interviews with people who have written extensively about violence and religion. And to help us get into the holiday spirit, we'll be playing a clip from Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ, which somehow didn't make it into the movie. We'll also be featuring the historic face-off between popular Christian icon and God, Jesus Christ, and the ever-good-natured yet decidedly non-submissive Easter Bunny. On this evening of Easter, and during this week of Passover, Equal Time for Free Thought asks, do Easter and Passover give us the foundational narratives of Judaism and Christian religions provide a basis for morality or for violence? The Judeo-Christian religions are purported to be the main source of ethical inspiration and social stability for the Western world. There are sound reasons to question whether our Judeo-Christian traditions might in actuality be a source for social chaos and violence. When it comes to violence, we seem to be at a fairly pivotal moment in our nation's history. Our attitudes regarding it have tremendous ramifications both here and abroad. Today, the United States has the largest prison population per capita in the Western world. Our administration insists that the only solution to the disastrous, unwinnable military adventure into which we've been plunged is to send in more troops and escalate the war. And if that's not enough to suggest that something significant is going on, last October, leaders voted to approve the Military Commissions Act of 2006, which denies those deemed to be enemy detainees the right of habeas corpus and protections against torture afforded by the Geneva Convention. Now, considering that the upper-level echelons of our government have no shortage of people claiming to be observant Christians, and even a few claiming to be observant Jews, if the Judeo-Christian traditions provided the moral guidance that its advocates claim, we might expect religious influence would prevent such examples of institutionalized brutality, such as long, harsh, punitive prison sentences, military solutions, and government-sanctioned torture. But sadly, this is not the case. Tonight, our guests will provide some insight as to why the Judeo-Christian tradition not only fails to curb institutionalized brutality, but actually helps make violent policies seem morally acceptable. So our first interview is with Dr. Daniel Rancourt Laferriere. Dr. Rancourt Laferriere is Emeritus Professor of Russian at the University of California at Davis. Receiving his doctorate in Slavic languages and literature at Brown University in 1972, he's taught at Tufts University and then the University of California at Davis. He has lectured on Russian themes in the U.S. and various countries in Western Europe and in Russia. He is the author of numerous books, including The Mind of Stalin, The Slave Soul of Russia, and the about-to-be-released-this-month book, Tolstoy's Quest for God. He's currently working on another book about the cross as a Christian symbol. Its tentative title is The Sign of the Cross from Jesus Christ to Adolf Hitler. Dr. Rancourt Laferriere is also the author of an essay titled The Moral Masochism at the Heart of Christianity, about which he's on the line right now to speak with us. Hello, Dr. Rancourt Laferriere, and welcome to Equal Time for Free Thought.
Hello, Arnell.
Yes.
It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Please go ahead and call me Daniel.
Okay, Daniel. Thank you for being with us on this Easter Sunday. Very much appreciate you being available. In your article, The Moral Masochism at the Heart of Christianity, which appeared in the spring 2003 issue of the Journal for the Psychoanalysis of Culture and Society, you wrote, Christ would not be Christ without his suffering and death on the cross. There'd be no Christianity without the cross. The cross is literally an instrument of torture and suffering. To understand the moral masochism which lies at the heart of Christianity, we must ever be reminding ourselves that Christ welcomed prolonged torture and eventual death upon a cross. So what is moral masochism, and how does Christianity promote it?
Well, those are two big questions.
Okay.
I would say that the fundamental teaching of Christianity is that we are saved, or we are redeemed, because of what Jesus did on the cross. What are we saved from? Well, we're saved from guilt, which eventually became the dogma of so-called original sin. How are we saved? We're saved by the crucifixion, and then by the resurrection, which is celebrated today, Easter Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question I ask in my ongoing research is, why would so powerful a figure as Christ God stoop so low as to permit himself to be crucified? The Christian God's utter abjection on the cross is difficult to reconcile with the ordinary idea of greatness that we assume, that we attribute to a God. So why did God not find some other way to solve the problem of universal human guilt? Being omnipotent by definition, why could God not invent some less horrific method for washing away the supposed stain of original sin?
Mm-hmm.
The patriarchal God of the Tanakh, or the what is the Hebrew Bible, had already punished humans by banning them from the Garden of Eden, you recall from the book of Genesis, and by inflicting upon them the pains of childbirth, toil, and mortality. Wasn't that enough to cleanse them of guilt?
Certainly was enough for me.
If we are to believe the innovative approach of the New Testament, it was not. The sadistic punishment of those guilt-ridden creatures of the Old Testament did not suffice, even if in some perverse way it could be interpreted as motivated by love. The new and improved God, that is to say the Christian God, insisted on punishing himself as well in the person of Jesus Christ.
Right, so you see...
This was a stroke of genius.
Yeah.
Christ was not the distant, unspeakable God of the Old Testament. He was a fellow human being. He emptied himself of his godhood and stood in for us. He took on and acted out to the fullest possible extent our need for punishment.
Hmm.
So he was not a sadist, or not only a sadist, he was a masochist.
Which was my next question, because it seems like not only is God a sadist, but in becoming Jesus, he then set this up to do this thing to himself, and he's a masochist. So why would a religion with a God who's both a sadist and a masochist become so successful?
Well, now you're getting ahead of the story there.
Okay, let's back up.
Let's back up a little bit to that term masochism. I think some people may not be familiar with it. As it's used in contemporary psychoanalysis anyway. Originally, of course, it was a sexual thing named after one Leopold von Sacher-Masoch, who was a Ukrainian novelist and wrote some novels about getting sexual pleasure from being beaten or whipped or otherwise punished. But in current psychoanalysis, masochism is defined as, and I'll quote a current study, any behavior, verbalization, or fantasy that by unconscious design is physically or psychically injurious to oneself, self-defeating, humiliating, or unduly self-sacrificing, unquote. That's a kind of standard definition. Examples from ordinary life could be, for example, the disturbed child who's always striking the head on or other parts of the body against available hard objects, or adolescents who are addicted to cutting themselves, or adults who are constantly getting into scrapes, for example, in their finances or in their personal relationships, which involve some kind of physical pain or psychical humiliation.
Mm-hmm.
In the clinical situation, masochism often manifests itself in the so-called negative therapeutic reaction, where the patient is very resistant to therapy precisely because the patient wants to continue suffering and doesn't necessarily know that, but prolongs the suffering.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So one might object that in Jesus' case, this painful self-injury and humiliation of the crucifixion are not carried out by unconscious design, which is what a psychoanalyst would want it to be, but are actually planned quite consciously and deliberately in advance. Thus we have the anticipations in the admonitions to carry one's cross that are repeated over and over again in the Gospels, the preaching of non-resistance to evil, the speech about a good shepherd who will lay down his life for his sheep, the various predictions of a coming betrayal, which, of course, will be affected by Judas, as we know, in the sacrificial aspect of the Last Supper, in Jesus' prayer of surrender in the Garden of Gethsemane, and so on and so forth. Now, on the other hand, if Jesus was God and therefore omniscient, as most Christians believe, then he could not have not known in advance how terribly he would suffer. And in any case, there are some masochists who are quite aware of how self-destructive their behavior is, and they can verbalize their awareness of this on the couch. So, nonetheless, they can't stop themselves from doing things that harm or humiliate themselves. So the masochism of Jesus is actually quite human in this respect.
So it doesn't, for it to qualify as masochism from a psychoanalytic perspective, it doesn't have to be unconscious.
No, it doesn't have to be.
No.
He knows he's going to get into trouble, Jesus does, just as many masochists do, and they can't stop themselves from doing it.
Right.
In the case of Jesus, both the Jewish and Roman authorities cannot stand idly by as Jesus gathers potentially disruptive crowds around him, and as he elicits cries about a kingdom that is to come and overturns the table of the money changers in the temple and speaks of the destruction of the temple and so on. He's asking for trouble. He's headed for self-sacrifice.
Yeah, yeah.
What is more problematical in this case is that the masochist in question also thinks, or he's represented as thinking in the Gospels, that he is God, the Lord God, Kurios, it is in the Greek.
Mm-hmm.
This is unusual. Most masochists are not also grandiose in their thinking, or at most they may feel only morally superior.
Mm-hmm.
Even more unusual is the fact that the masochist in this case also manages to convince many other people around him that he is God.
Mm-hmm.
So Jesus was a grandiose masochist with charisma.
Yeah.
Analysts rarely ever see such an interesting patient. There is probably no other instance in history where a grandiose masochist was coherent enough and talented enough to convince substantial numbers of people of his divine identity, thereby launching an orally transmitted tradition which had the momentum ultimately to become an enormous scripture-based worldwide church.
Well, it seems, you know, it seems
other,
like
other charismatic masochists have had to settle for sort of temporary notoriety. For example, the Reverend Jim Jones of the famous Jonestown Massacre and suicide.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea that Jesus was a masochist may be repellent to, you know, practicing Christians who would find it more reassuring to believe that Jesus redeemed us by his generous self-sacrificial behavior than to admit that he was a mere human being, albeit represented in the Bible as clinically disturbed and charismatic.
Right. You suggest that Christ's ordeal has hardly changed the behavior of people. You state that Orthodox Christians can continue to commit acts for which they feel guilty, but now they can always count on their merciful Christ, their ideal and idealized masochist, to take on at least some of the burden of their guilt.
That's right.
And,
that's right.
Yeah.
And so they can sin, repent, and sin again. And this sin can take many forms. It can be anything from sexual misbehavior to violent aggression against other people. And if we know anything about the history of Christianity, we know that violence perpetrated against other people has been one of the great hallmarks of Christianity. And often it's done under the sign of the cross. That is to say, the Crusaders went out. The definition of a crusade is to take up the cross and fight the infidel, and, you know, kill a lot of Jews on the way. That happened in the 11th and 12th centuries. There were pogroms against the Jews in the Rhineland as the Crusaders headed toward the Holy Land to kill the infidel, that is to say, Muslims. So, in the name of the cross, violence has been perpetrated. Now, how can that square with the idea of non-resistance to evil preached by Christ? Well, but it's in the gospel, too. For example, the Jews are accused of being the killers of Christ. This naturally will elicit feelings of revenge in Christians. And often the justification given by Christians for anti-Semitism is this so-called charge of deicide. That is, you Jews killed Christ. We're going to kill you now.
So it seems that you're suggesting that Christianity, with its sadistic, masochistic implications, is hardly a source of social stability and morality.
Well,
or I should say effective. I mean, for example, I know that you're specialized in Russian studies, and you talk about in your work the sadistic elements in the sadistic masochistic elements in the Russian Orthodox Church, and you say that it seems disproportionately sadomasochistic compared to other Christian nations. Is that right?
Well, yes, I would say Russian Orthodoxy, Pravoslavia, as it's called in Russian, is another Christian religion, but it's somewhat more Christian than most Christians. For example, anti-Semitism. Anti-Jewish sentiments, anti-Judaism, whatever you want to call it. It's always the same. It's some kind of hatred against the Jews. It is very, very well represented in Russian Orthodoxy. The very word pogrom is a Russian word.
Right, right.
The pogroms were perpetrated against the Jews in late Imperial Russia, and many Jews managed to escape, there was a great influx of the Jewish population in both Western Europe and in North America as a result. The Germans were a little bit more organized, however, than the Russians. They didn't have pogroms. They had a Holocaust.
Right.
And it's my feeling, and this is something I'm working on right now, that Adolf Hitler, who was, by the way, brought up a Catholic and once actually thought of entering a monastery and becoming a monk, Adolf Hitler adopted the so-called swastika as a version of the sign of the cross. Now, why do I say that? It's well known that the word swastika comes from the Sanskrit swastika, which is a sign of good fortune and so on in India.
Mm-hmm.
However, in German, if you're thinking in German, if you're reading Hitler's Mein Kampf in German, the word is Hakenkreuz, which means hooked cross.
Hooked cross. Right.
A swastika really shouldn't be called that in the context of the Holocaust. It should be called a cross. This was a crime perpetrated by Christians against Jews.
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority of Nazis were Christians of either Catholic or Protestant backgrounds, and they were the ones who perpetrated this Holocaust under the leadership of this very orderly and organized Nazi administration.
So it seems like you're suggesting that the strong Christian influences do nothing to abate very, very damaging, hurtful, and violent behaviors. It seems
well,
like...
I wouldn't say that.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say nothing to abate.
Okay.
I would say in some instances, Christianity actually accomplishes reduction of violence. I think of the Quakers. I think of some of the followers of Tolstoy. I think of, you know, some of the people who have actually practiced non-resistance to evil and thereby have reduced violence.
Right, but
this is
overall,
this is a minority among Christians.
Right, right. Because overall, it seems like it also is capable of rationalizing a great deal of immoral acts.
It certainly is. It is. The charge of deicide, for example, is a way of rationalizing violence against Jews.
Yes. Yeah. No. Absolutely. We have outtake, which is exclusive to Equal Time for Free Thought, from the recent Mel Gibson movie, The Passion, which I'd like you to listen to. If I could just kind of set it up here, basically, it's at a crucial point where basically we're talking about the sadomasochistic element of the crucifixion, and Jesus is trying to remember a word, a safe word, that would make it all stop. And let's listen to that.
All right.
Okay, here we go.
Ow. 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 I wish I could remember that safe word. What was it now? This isn't funny. Rumples the skin? No, that wasn't it. Unicorn. No.
Uncle. That's not the word.
Yes, I'm not sure that that's entirely an accurate depiction of the scene, but that seems somewhat consistent with what you're...
Actually haven't been able to bring myself to watch that film yet, but certainly it makes the Jews look bad, and Pope at the time, in his reaction to this film, says it is as it was. That is to say, Mel Gibson's representation is a true representation of what took place at the time of the crucifixion of Jesus. And this certainly is a statement not designed to promote peace between Christians and Jews.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So your new project deals with Christianity as well.
Yes. In fact, it's primarily about Christianity and all of the variants of Christianity which take the sign of the cross seriously.
Do you think that the Russian culture was particularly more sadistic before the onset of Orthodox Christianity, or do you think that...
the history of Orthodoxy in Russia goes back to the year 988. That's when they weren't Russians yet. They were called Rusians. They were the inhabitants of a medieval kind of feudal princedom headed in Kiev, nowadays Ukraine. And they were baptized. They were dunked into the Dnieper River and baptized as Christians. And for a long time, they continued their pagan practices alongside their Christian practices. There was constant violence, regardless of the introduction of Christianity. Christian princes were warring against each other, trying to claim authority to run various localities, and eventually trying to claim authority to the throne of what would eventually become Muscovite Russia,
right,
and then eventually authority as the Tsar.
Do you think, we're just a little low on time, do you think that Christianity had a more civilizing effect in terms of reducing sadistic violence when it came, or do you think that it basically...
As far as I can see, there was only an increase in violence after 988,
right,
and violence became extreme to the point where most of the Russian population was enslaved. That is to say, we had the institution of serfdom, and that was not lifted until 1861.
So all in all, it seems like, I know that in your article you say that you think Christianity has a level of self-righteousness that's hardly called for.
Right.
How could the humiliation of one man save humankind? And
There's no evidence that things have been better since Jesus.
Yeah, I hear you.
There's no redemption. I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
Where's the evidence?
Yeah, we
just,
want
just these pockets of Quakers and non-resistors, but overall, Christianity has been a disaster. Now, it has also been a civilizing influence insofar as, universities have been founded, countries have come into existence which might not otherwise.
Right, but that deals with secular life. I mean, all those benefits really have to do with people that were kind of rolling up their sleeves and looking at this world and trying to figure out how to make it a better place.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. It's secular life from our viewpoint today, but when these places were founded, they were founded in the name of Christ. These were Christian princes who became heads of state, which eventually did become secularized.
Right.
Christianity was very important in their foundation.
Yes, yes, I hear you. So your new book is coming out this month. Tolstoy's Search for God, right?
Tolstoy's Quest for God.
Quest for God.
It's coming out with Transition Publishers the end of April, early May.
Excellent. So, Dr. Daniel Rancourt-Laferriere, well, thank you so much for being with us on this Easter day on Equal Time for Free Thought.
You're very welcome.
And,
my pleasure.
And hopefully we can have you back on again soon sometime.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So, our second interview is with Dr. James Prescott, who had been a guest on this program in the past. Our discussion was pre-recorded. Dr. Prescott is a developmental and cross-cultural neuropsychologist. From 1963 to 1980, he served as the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development's Health Science Administrator. Inspired by Harry Harlow's controversial experiments on the damaging effects of deprivation of maternal affection to infant rhesus monkeys, Dr. Prescott studied anthropological data which had been collected on 40 primitive cultures. This work resulted in him forming a two-stage deprivation theory of violence. In his article, Body Pleasure and the Origins of Violence, published in November 1975 in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, Dr. Prescott demonstrated that his findings overwhelmingly supported the thesis that deprivation of body pleasure throughout life, but particularly during formative periods of infancy, childhood, and adolescence, are very closely related to the amount of warfare and interpersonal violence we could expect within a given society. The statistics associated with this relationship were extraordinarily strong. There's a 98% likelihood that if a society is physically affectionate toward its infants and tolerant of premarital sexual behavior, it would be nonviolent. In the years which followed, Prescott examined the many ways in which our culture fails to be supportive of the type of mother-infant relationship that is adequately long, which is at least 2.5 years, and as well physically affectionate, including breastfeeding, baby carrying, and baby wearing. He also looked at why our culture is so repressive toward healthy sexuality, particularly among adolescents, since his work indicated that a tendency toward violence in societies which had low mother-infant affection could be offset by a high tolerance of sexual expression during the developmental stage of adolescence. Prescott's conclusion was inescapable. Rather than promoting civility and peace through a multitude of religious writings, traditions, and practices which treat physical pleasure as evil and pain as sacred, our Judeo-Christian religions ensure that society would be continually plagued with violence and social pathology. Let's listen to this sound clip from a Canadian television documentary called Violence from the mid-70s, featuring Dr. Prescott's groundbreaking work.
And what I found was that the cultures which provided high infant physical affection were very low in physical violence as adults.
Dr. Prescott looked at 49 primitive cultures and found that by far the majority were peaceful. He found they treated their children with affectionate tolerance, the same tolerance they showed to adult sexuality. It was a different story in the tribes that were notoriously ferocious. They either treated their kids harshly or their adults because of repressive sexual taboos. Prescott claims it's our Judeo-Christian tradition that's responsible. Mortification of the flesh is good for us. Pain and punishment build character. Touching for physical pleasure is wrong. And that's the root of our distorted attitude to sex.
We have legal authorities taking action against pornographic films, against massage parlors. That's right out of Corinthians. In contrast, we have a whole variety of films of sexual violence, and that isn't even touched. So we have Apple Orange, Soho, we have many films of sexual violence, particularly rape, which can run in our neighborhood theaters, and there is no objection by the authorities for this kind of sexual violence. So it's not sexuality that is the issue. The issue is pleasure. Pleasure is immoral.
Next, we have Dr. Prescott himself addressing this point at the beginning of his recent interview with Equal Time for Free Thought.
Hello, Dr. Prescott, and welcome back to Equal Time for Free Thought.
Yes, I'm glad to be back on your show.
Excellent. Your work indicates that our Judeo-Christian tradition is actually responsible for a great deal of violence prevalent in our society. Could you explain why?
Well, the Judeo-Christian theology of salvation depends upon an ethic of pain, suffering, and deprivation. These are moral virtues.
Right.
And the complement of that is that moral sin, the experience in the physical pleasures, are the moral sins that are to be avoided. And it is this combination that has led to so much alienation and violence in human societies.
While in the Christian religion, the emphasis on suffering is rather blatant, Dr. Prescott points out that it's rather quite pronounced in the Jewish religion as well. In an article titled Genital Pain versus Genital Pleasure, Why the One and Not the Other, Dr. Prescott writes, the diminution of sexual pleasure is a major reason for circumcision in the Jewish religious tradition. And then he offers this passage from Moses Maimonides in the Guide for the Perplexed, which was written in the year 1190. Quote, with regard to circumcision, one of the reasons for it is the wish to bring about a decrease in sexual intercourse and a weakening of the organ in question so that this activity may be diminished and the organ may be in as quiet a state as possible. The bodily pain caused to that member is the real purpose of circumcision. The fact that circumcision weakens the faculty of sexual excitement and sometimes perhaps diminishes the pleasure is indubitable. For if at birth this member has been made to bleed and has had its cover taken from it, it must indubitably be weakened. Our sages distinctly say it is hard for a woman with whom an uncircumcised man had sexual intercourse to separate from him. This, as I believe, is the best reason for the commandment concerning circumcision. Prescott also writes, elsewhere in the Jewish tradition, clear warnings are given concerning the dangers of sexual pleasure. The following quotations are taken from the Code of Jewish Law. The sin of discharging semen in vain. It's forbidden to discharge semen in vain. This is a greater sin than any other method mentioned in the Torah. Those who practice masturbation cause the issue of semen in vain. Not only do they commit a grave sin, but they are under a ban concerning whom it is said, your hands are full of blood, and it's equivalent to killing a person. Occasionally, as a punishment for the sin, children die when young, God forbid, it says, or grow up to be delinquent while the sinner himself is reduced to poverty. Prescott then goes on to point out that the Roman Catholic Church also affirms the moral value of pain and suffering, obviously, quoting from the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius of Loyola from the year 1541. The third kind of penance is to chastise the body, that is, to inflict sensible pain on it. This is done by wearing hair shirts, cords, or iron chains on the body, or by scourging or wounding oneself, and by other kinds of austerity. In the next clip, Dr. Prescott talks about first the Jewish religion, then the Christian.
Well, one of the things that caught my attention was an email communication from Rabbi Lerner.
You're talking about Rabbi Michael Lerner from Tikkun magazine.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he was nominated as the 28th most important rabbi in America.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a statement that he made, which I'd like to pull from.
Mm-hmm.
He says, pleased as I am by this attention, I'd feel much more honored if the list had been constructed around which rabbis are most true to God and God's message of love, generosity, kindness, peace, and justice, and caring for the earth. So I want to invite people around the U.S. to nominate such rabbis, and we will announce the 50 most faithful to God's message in a future issue of Tikkun magazine. Now, I find this an incredible statement, because God the Father is anything but a symbol of love and generosity and kindness and peace.
Right. So, in other words, he was nominated as being one of the 28 most
important rabbis
in
America.
And he would have been happier if he was on a list of the most faithful to God.
Exactly. And the thing of it is that God the Father is the most pathological, violent entity described in the Old Testament. He's been responsible for the killing of children, for genocide, the flood, killing innocent people.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's really extraordinary of the pathological violence of God the Father.
Yes.
And so we have to look at it, you know, in terms of where is the origin of violence from these religious systems. And it can be traced to God the Father. And for Christianity, it's the crucifixion. I mean, here, God the Father declared that the Word would become flesh, and for what reason? To be crucified. And to make things worse, he called this an act of love. For you had in John, God loved the world so much that he gave or murdered his only son, that everyone who has faith in him may not die but have eternal life. Here we have divine filicide being perpetrated, but it was the foundation of the entire Christian religion. How can Judaism, Christianity, and Muslim, but particularly Christianity, claim that they are a religion of love when, in fact, their religion is founded on an act of brutal violence?
Right. Yes.
So one has to look at this broader structure on what constitutes the moral path, personal salvation, which is really pain, suffering, and deprivation.
Because in the decades since he conducted his groundbreaking research, it has become popular for public figures to diminish the importance of environmental factors in shaping people's behavior. In our first interview, I asked Dr. Prescott what he thought of this trend.
Today, people who are basically dismissive of the influence of environmental factors and emphasize the influence of genes, like Steven Pinker, seem to be the darlings of humanists and academics everywhere. What do you think about that?
Well, the environment is overwhelmingly more important than genes.
Mm-hmm.
There's no living organism that can grow up to be a healthy, functioning organism by living in a toxic environment.
Right.
And so I think that says it all. And the environment does regulate and control gene expression.
That does say it all.
And one might think that among those who have successfully cast off the traditional shackles of shame and guilt, which religion teachings cause us to associate with bodily pleasure and sexuality, there'd be a powerful shift in attitude and behavior. Surprisingly, however, as Dr. Prescott shows, it's hardly the case. Considering the significant implications of the issue, we might expect that atheists and humanists who have rejected the precepts of religion don't have the burden of having to square their position with Jesus or Jehovah would be as positive about sexuality and bodily pleasure as religion is negative. Yet, Dr. Prescott reports that when it comes to promoting healthy bodily pleasure attitudes, modern humanists and secular organizations are virtually indistinguishable from their religious counterparts. Even worse, they've refused to take a stand against institutionalized infliction of pain on children. Prescott's recent experience with so-called humanism was having leading humanist Paul Kurtz refuse to sign on to a petition started by Ashley Montague, critical of the damaging and unnecessary act of circumcision. And Prescott writes, Paul Kurtz had refused to have his organization, Council of Secular Humanists, endorse this resolution based upon policy considerations. I suggested that he change the policy to protect the children of the world from genital mutilation. He refused. The failure of modern humanism is apparent. Dr. Prescott related that the core problem is an overestimation of the importance of our intellect over all else. Here's what he had to say about the failings of modern humanism.
Do you find that your voice resonates with the existing secular groups?
Well, not really. I think where modern humanism has taken a wrong turn is that they have made a god out of the neocortical, thinking, rational, cognitive brain.
Mm-hmm.
That we can talk ourselves out of the problems that we have created because of the damage we've done to our emotional, social, sexual brain, which is done very early in life, beginning with infancy and childhood. And you take a look at the so-called humanist programs, you don't find virtually any of them addressing these issues.
Right, right.
You don't.
And
so it's all, you know, and also this is generally true of most of the peacemaking program. It all comes from the cognitive thinking, rational brain.
Mm-hmm.
And where do you find being emphasized the importance of children, the importance of the mother-infant relationship?
Right. Right.
You know, and so I guess this is why I've given up on institutionalized humanism, because they are not addressing the core issues.
In the final segment of our interview, Dr. Prescott elaborated a bit about why the emphasis on only intellect is the result of misunderstanding from where it is that our ability to be cooperative, moral, and peaceful are derived. He explained how primate research can give us a better understanding of ourselves, and how research on the very peaceful primate, the bonobo, also verify the very findings of his own research.
Let me mention a book that I think would be useful for your...
Yeah, for our listeners, yes.
Your listeners. By Franz de Waal.
Mm-hmm.
Primates and Philosophers.
Okay.
Morality Evolved.
Primates and Philosophers, Morality Evolved.
How Morality Evolved
by Franz de Waal. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and he's the primatologist. He makes a very, very convincing case for the roots of morality to be found in our emotional, social, sexual brain, not really to be found in the intellectualized, rational, cognitive brain. Comes
right.
much later in evolution, comes much later in development. The bonobo chimpanzee has all the key ingredients that the few human cultures that I've looked at have. The mothers breastfeed to about 4 years of age.
Right.
They carry the infant on the body to almost adolescence, and they have multisexual relations. And so they are a nonviolent primate. They're the most peaceful primate on the planet.
Dr. Prescott strongly calls for everyone to stand up and stop the way we elevate pain and disparage bodily pleasure. Writing, before male violence against women can end, before human violence can be eliminated, a moral revolution must take place. Pain must be declared immoral, and pleasure must be declared morally necessary if we're to become moral persons. In summary, dualistic, theistic, moral foundations of Western civilization must be transformed if human equality, compassion, justice, and love are to be realized, and if the human species is to survive. Dr. Prescott's work can be found at www.violence.de, www.violence.de. And for our final feature, we have, by popular demand, Jesus versus the Easter Bunny. Here it is.
Good evening, and welcome to a special Easter Sunday edition of The Petrified Mind, with me, your host, Giles Ferguson. The Petrified Mind, bringing you the cutting edge of controversy in the multifaceted world of modern religion. Tonight, the pious versus the popular, as we feature the long-awaited confrontation between Christian Messiah and Son of God, Jesus Christ, and the ever-popular and somewhat roguish rascal, the Easter Bunny. And now for our debate. All right, gentlemen, let's start up with brief opening statements. First, let's hear from Jesus Christ, Son of God.
Am I on?
Yes, yes, proceed.
Oh, all right then. Well, I don't think there's any question that Easter is a sacred religious holiday for the observance of the infinite mercy of our Holy Father as embodied by the sacrifice and ultimate resurrection of me, his only begotten Son.
Go on.
Yes, and I think that rather than helping to make the miracle of my resurrection known to all, the rabbit represents a damaging distraction, and even worse, the brazen animal seems to encourage immoral merriment and pleasures of the flesh.
And so you propose?
The rabbit should remove himself from the limelight. Rather than deliver brightly colored baskets filled with various objects of sensual indulgence, he should instead remind people that Easter is a time to honor he who died for their sins. He should admonish them to attend church and repent.
I see. Mr. Buddy?
Woo! I don't even know where to begin. Jesus!
Yes?
That was only an expression. First, let me say that I'm no prophet.
You can say that again.
And I certainly can't deliver a sermon, but I can tell you this. This guy's all wrong about Easter. Easter is for having fun and celebrating the end of winter. Easter is about the wondrous birth of a new life. a time filled with promise and innocence, when even old people feel young.
Von, ha! You think my blood is about birth and innocence? It is not. My ordeal concerned the absorption of sin.
What sin? Jesus, you're all hung up on this sin thing. You gotta lighten up.
Lighten up? Why don't you try enduring the horrendous ordeal which I suffered through on Good Friday, and then try to lighten up by Sunday? And I might add that it's all very tastefully depicted in my latest picture, The Passion of the Christ, now showing at theaters everywhere near you.
Fine. You suffered and died for everyone's sins. So what?
So what?
Yeah, so what? I mean, it's not as if the world has had any less suffering because of your suffering. And it's not as if the world has had any less death because you died. Really, as far as everyday life is concerned, I don't see a bit of difference. You?
That's not the point.
Not the point? Then pray tell, what is the point?
Look, you deluded hare. Try as you may to make light of my sacrifice on the cross, with God as my witness, I can say to you with absolute certainty, it is only because of me that this world has been saved.
Great. Now the world is safe. Let's all enjoy it. Jeez, do you always have to be such a martyr? Get over it.
I swear this rabbit is surely Satan's spawn. Hear me now, you cursed cottontail. I am the world's savior. I died for the sins of the world, and it is only I who offers eternal life. What do you offer? Chocolate eggs? Jelly beans?
Yeah, and don't forget the marshmallow bunnies.
Yuck. How can I reason with the likes of a creature like you? Have you no shame? You are a usurper. Your preposterous popularity threatens to eclipse the true and solemn original meaning of Easter.
Oh, really?
Really.
Well, okay. I wasn't going to go into this, but now you've opened the door.
Oh, I'm so scared.
So, I'm the usurper, huh?
That is correct, sir.
Okay, then tell me this. Why is Easter called Easter?
That has nothing to do with it. Giles, this is obviously a manipulative tactic to which I must object.
Oh, I'm afraid I'm inclined to allow it.
Don.
I repeat, why is Easter called Easter?
I don't know.
Oh, I think you do.
No, I really can't say.
Could it have anything to do with something bright and warm that lights up the spring sky?
Well, I have no idea.
Come on, Jesus, answer the question. Easter is called Easter because that big, bright, beautiful sun rises in the...
Jesus?
In the east.
You got that one right. And celebrating the coming of the sun is only the beginning. Easter is and always has been a joyous time to celebrate the long-awaited arrival of spring. It's a time when the frozen streams start to run, a time when the flowers begin to bloom, and it's a time when spring fever drives every self-respecting bunny into a frenzy of copulation with a multitude of partners, sweet and meaningless. Whoa! Just talking about it makes me horny.
Do you see what I'm dealing with here? The rabbit is a depraved little slut. Woe unto you, immoral bunny. Unless you and those who follow in your wanton ways change, I can assure you that no place at the side of God shall await you.
I can live with that.
Yes, but can you die with it? That's the real question. But you probably never bother yourself with such eternal matters, do you?
All I know is I do what comes naturally, what feels good. And you know what? So do you.
Me? Moi? The bunny must be joking. Have I lived a life of earthly indulgence? I think not. No, my life has been a solitary existence, dutiful and chaste. And as anyone who watches my new motion picture, The Passion of the Christ, now playing at theaters everywhere, could plainly see, being depicted in graphic detail, A life punctuated by intense suffering, pain and blood. Lots and lots of blood.
Like I said, I do what comes naturally for me. And you do what comes naturally for you.
What do you mean?
I mean to each his own. After all, there are lots of people for whom the path to pleasure is pain.
Oh, really?
Really?
Go on.
Why, I could take you to certain spots in the West Village right now where pain and pleasure are seen as one and the same.
Like two sides of the same coin?
Exactly.
Ooh, could we go to Sheridan Square?
Sure thing. Just follow me. But could you just try not to get any blood on my fur?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I suppose I am a little raw.
Yeah. Hey, you want a jelly bean?
Is there an orange one? I'm getting so tired of red.
Yeah, I think I got what you want right here. Here you go.
Well, there they go, God and Bunny.
Do you remember back in the 70s, there used to be a club called the Ramrod?
Yeah, but they were shut down by the Board of Health.
Pity, pity.
Well, I guess that about does it. This has been your host, Giles Ferguson, hoping you'll tune in again for yet another edition of The Petrified Mind. Until then, here's wishing the very best to you and yours.